coming up next on the Jordan Harbinger Show.
The people who flourished had satisfying relationships. The people who floundered did not have satisfying relationships, period. It didn't matter the money. It actually didn't matter the physical health. And even the guy who started this, he has a really interesting unpublished paper with the results. And he says, I can describe the results of this like 7-decade study in human flourishing. I can describe it in 5 words. Happiness is love, full stop. I don't want to get woo-woo on you, but he's totally right.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most fascinating people. We have in-depth conversations with astronauts, entrepreneurs, spies, and psychologists, even the occasional former cult member, Russian spy, or tech mogul. And each episode turns our guests' wisdom into practical advice you can use to build a deeper understanding of how the world works and become a better critical thinker. If you're new to the show or you're looking for a handy way to tell your friends about it, we've got episode starter packs. These are collections of top episodes organized by topic that'll help new listeners get a taste of everything we do here on the show. You can find those on Spotify or go to jordanharbinger.com/start to get started or to help somebody else get started with us. And of course, I always appreciate it when you do that. Today, my friend and best-selling author Dan Pink is back on the show. We'll discuss the power of regret, namely, how we can not only help mitigate regrets we already have and ease the pain of those regrets, but also how we can use some very practical tactics and strategies to avoid regret in the first place. One of my favorite exercises in here will actually show us how to reverse engineer regrets so that they never even happen and keep us focused on what's really important in our lives. Really insightful conversation here with a brilliant thinker. And if you're wondering how I manage to book all these authors, thinkers, and creators every single week, it's because of my network. And I'm teaching you how to build your network for free over at jordanharbinger.com/course. The course is about improving your networking skills, your connection skills, and inspiring others to develop a personal and professional relationship with you. It'll make you a better networker, a better connector, and a better thinker. That's jordanharbinger.com/course. And most of the guests you hear on the show, they subscribe and contribute to the course, so come join us. You'll be in smart company where you belong. Now, here's Dan Pink. So no regrets. It's funny, as soon as I saw the title of your book, I was like, this reminds me of that tattoo that you see everywhere that says no regrets on it. And sure enough, you mention it right at the jump, which is great. That means that meme has saturated when it ends up in a book about regrets and it's not just some Reddit fodder. That's a real deal thing.
Absolutely. And it really got me thinking, like, why is that clip so popular? This idea of this kid has a tattoo that says no regrets. And Jason Sudeikis says, you know, not even one letter. And what it shows is that, you know, it's another way of getting into the main point of this book, which is that everybody has regrets. They're ubiquitous. They're universal. The only people without regrets are 5-year-olds, people with brain damage, and sociopaths. The rest of us have regrets. And as you know from the book, Jordan, you know, I found a lot of people with tattoos that say no regrets or no ragrets. But of course, I also found a guy who got a no regrets tattoo, regretted the decision, and had it removed.
I mean, that's probably what most of the people are doing with no regrets tattoos, depending on the location of said tattoo.
Yes.
I used to run a company where we had like live coaching and stuff, and guys would come and stay from all over the world. And I've since sort of left that life behind. But one story that sticks with me is a guy flew in from South Africa, really cool guy. His name, Sean Willems, shout out, because you didn't do this, and it's not as embarrassing as one might think if you actually got it. But he's walking around, he's like drunk, 3 o'clock in the morning, and he's like, I just hear about it in the morning. I hear, mate, thanks so much for not letting me get that tattoo the other night. And the guy's like, yeah, no problem, man. I just knew it would have been a mistake. And I was like, you're going to get a tattoo on Hollywood Boulevard at 3 a.m.? And he's like, yeah, man. I was like, what was the tattoo going to say? Oh, I was going to get no regrets right here on my forearm. And I'm like, oh my God, the irony. But also, wow, thank God you didn't do that.
Absolutely.
Oof. In giant, absolutely, like old English font too, just like the most hideous, sorest.
Yeah, yeah. And believe me, in this research, I've seen a lot of no regrets tattoos, more than one person should ever be exposed to in a lifetime.
And I suppose the locations vary as well.
Yes, they do vary. You know, I got people with no regrets tattoo like behind their ear, somebody on their wrist, somebody on their forearm, somebody on their butt. So everywhere.
Yeah. Oh man, anything above the neckline is kind of like that's no regrets and no career prospects potentially alongside it, unless you're a tattoo artist or something like that.
Yeah.
Why is it a flawed ideology? You mentioned that the only people with no regrets are kids and sociopaths. Sometimes it's hard to tell one from the other. Why is, speaking of a man with toddlers, why is having no regrets not really a realistic outlook on life or a realistic philosophy.
It's flawed for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's profoundly unrealistic because truly everybody has regrets. And the reason everybody has regrets is that if we treat them right, regrets are useful. Regrets clarify, they instruct. If you look at the research here, what the research tells us is that regret is the most common negative emotion that we have. And arguably the second, in some research done by Susan Shimanoff several years ago, the second most common emotion that people express of any kind after love. And so this no regrets philosophy seems like this courageous act, but it's not. It's not an act of courage. What's an act of courage is looking your regrets in the eye and addressing them. And when we do that, the benefits are huge. There's a pile of research showing that it helps us make better decisions, that it improves our problem-solving skills, our negotiation skills, our strategic skills, deepens our sense of meaning. And so what I want to do is sort of reclaim this idea of regret. I think it's actually our most indispensable emotion, and it points a way to how to have a good life.
Yeah, there's a lot of people probably nodding their head, but also, I mean, something about saying, hey, no regrets, it's comforting.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I will say that most of these like self-help grifters that you and I have probably come across, because we know a lot of the same people, you hear that a lot. They love this phrase.
Totally.
You hear it in those like, I don't know if you've ever been duped into those like self-help seminars where you get there and they're like, everything you've done in your life, no regrets, it's led you to this place. And I'm like, are you just trying to reframe all my bad decisions as a divine journey to come here and give you money? Because that's sure as shit what it sounds like.
I think the answer is yes, that is exactly what they are trying to do.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's ludicrous, it's bullshit, if you'll forgive the phrase.
Yeah.
Because our cognitive machinery is programmed for regret. Mm-hmm. If we didn't have regret, we would not be able to survive. And the question really is this. I think you make a great point, Jordan. Regret makes us uncomfortable. And so a natural response to that is to ignore it, to say, I don't ever look backward, no regrets, okay? That's a recipe for delusion. Now, because we haven't been taught how to deal with it, another response is to let it in and be hobbled by it. That's a bad idea too. What we have to do is we have to look these regrets in the eye and think about them. And when we act like grownups and do that, it is a powerful, powerful force for progress. And the idea that we can elude regrets is nonsense. I did a piece of research of my own for this book. We did a big public opinion survey of 4,489 Americans. And I asked people the question about regret without using the word.
Mm.
I said, how, because of exactly this kind of this sort of self-help nonsense that you're talking about. There are something like 50-something books in the Library of Congress whose title is No Regrets. And we're out of control. But I asked people this question. How often do you look back on your life and wish you had done something differently? We had 1% say never.
Wow.
Okay. We had something like 16% said rarely. 83% said they do it occasionally. So over 4 out of 5 Americans say, yeah, I do that occasionally. And the reason for that, they're human beings. That's what human beings do. The question is, are we willing to confront our regrets? If we do it in a systematic way, they are a powerful force for forward progress, particularly coming out of this pandemic.
I know for me, and I'm sure this is probably true for everyone, but since you took a survey, negative emotion teaches me a lot. And not just like big regrets where I go, oh man, I probably shouldn't have gone to school for vet school when I hate animals. You know, there's big regrets like that. Or I shouldn't have married that person who I knew was a con artist. There's small regrets like, you know, that was a bad reaction to that particular situation. I should not have yelled at my kid for peeing on the floor. It's my fault. He had to go to the bathroom so bad. You know, like that kind of stuff. That happens all the time. That's my primary mode of learning, Dan.
Because you're a human being. And this is exactly right. Here's the thing. We have never been taught, and when I say we, I mean really Americans, we have never been taught how to deal with negative emotions.
Mm.
We think that the only emotions that you should have are positive emotions. And what science tells us, all right, forget about anybody's lived experience. What science tells us is that positive emotions are extraordinarily important. We want to have positive emotions. We want to have a lot of positive emotions. We want to have more positive emotions than negative emotions. Positive emotions are fantastic. But they are not the only thing, all right? And negative emotions serve a purpose. There's a reason why our brains are able to feel bad. Feeling bad helps us do better if we know what to do about it. And so let's take an extreme example. I don't believe in fear. I don't feel fear. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're a dead man. Like the building's burning. I don't feel fear. Okay, what is fear telling you? Fear is useful. And the thing is, I'm convinced that regret is our most useful emotion, negative emotion, maybe the most useful emotion overall, because here's what it does. We look backward. We say, ah, crap. All right. Mm-hmm. We deal with the pain. We say, what is that pain telling me? And then we extract a lesson from it to go forward. Regret is transformative. It instructs. If we deal with it right and get past this nonsense that it's somehow debilitating or unhuman to have regrets, when in fact, it is among the most human things that people will experience.
Yeah, you mentioned kids' brains, and I think you said injured brains, like sociopaths, or people who've literally had like a closed head injury or something along those lines. So it's a normal part of a mature brain, regret. But no regrets, it makes sense that people who have brain damage can't really experience, or in some occasions don't experience regret. It also explains a lot about those self-help seminars we just talked about. And I think you talk about this in the book. Regret is, do you relate it to a time machine? I believe I read that, right? Where you can go back in time.
Because here's the thing. Regret is an incredible thing that our minds can do. This is one reason why. How old are your kids?
2.5 and 1 month. So not old enough to have any. Right. The timeline is so short.
But here's the thing. Your kids, it's going to take them a few years for their brains to grow and do. Your 1 month old obviously can't speak and can't walk because it's a boy or a girl.
It's a girl, yeah. She can't walk or do anything, really.
She hasn't learned to do that stuff. It's not because she's a flawed person. It's because she's 1 month old, you know? And so she's going to learn how to do that. Her brain and body are going to develop. And our brain develops this ability for regret. But it's cognitively extremely complex. It's extremely complex. If I take one of the regrets that I captured out there where someone says, okay, let's take one of the marriage ones. If only I hadn't married that idiot. They regret marrying that idiot. What happens? They go back in time, all right? They time travel in their head. They go back in time. They negate what really happened. Then they get back in their time machine, go forward, and imagine a refashioned present because of their decision they made in the past. I mean, it's so cognitively complex, it makes sense that little kids, tiny little kids, can't do it. It makes sense that if you have lesions in the orbital frontal cortex of your brain, you can't do it. If you have certain kinds of Huntington's disease or certain kinds of Parkinson's disease, it doesn't work. It's incredibly complex. It's something that our species does. And if it's something that our species does, the odds are very good it has maintained itself over our evolution for a reason. And the reason is that regret is ubiquitous because regret is useful.
Yes.
And that's the point. And so I want to try to reclaim this emotion and show people how to use it as a force for forward progress.
Yeah, I really like that. It is this time travel, this mental time travel, is that the same as counterfactual thinking or is that a different concept?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Perfectly said. Regret is a form of counterfactual thinking. So we think counter to the facts. So what you can think about, and this is actually useful as we think about our lives, to oversimplify a bit, you can do an upward counterfactual. If only I hadn't married that, guys, how could things have been better? Mm. But you can also do a downward counterfactual. At least I stayed in that marriage only a year, all right? How could it have been worse? And there's some fascinating research, fairly familiar now, but well-validated, is about Olympic athletes.
Yes.
If you look at the photographs of Olympic athletes, Olympic medalists, routinely bronze medalists look happier than silver medalists. Bronze medalists look happier than silver medalists. The silver medalists objectively, unequivocally, have outperformed them. What's going on? The silver medalist is saying, if only, doing a counterfactual, if only I kicked a little harder, I'd be a gold medalist. The bronze medalist is saying, at least I didn't finish fourth and miss a medal altogether.
Yeah.
And so counterfactual thinking is something that human beings do. It's glorious. It's incredible. You can't imagine a raccoon doing counterfactual thinking, right? It's something that our species does. And once again, why are we able to do it? Because it's useful.
Right, right. Yeah, you do feel for the silver medalist because, especially when it's like, oh, 1/100th of a second behind on that swim lap, and you're like, man, you breathed out your nose more out of your left nostril than your right nostril, and now you're not a gold medalist.
I always think about that when I watch the Olympics, especially in swimming, because like civilians, it's hard for them to, I even think about the training. It's like, well, my goal this year is to shave 5/100ths of a second off of my time. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Like, I can't even think in those kinds of units. Mm-hmm. And the idea of devoting a year to doing that, but I admire that dedication. And I'm a sports fan, so any chance I have to sort of analogize from sports or use sports examples, I tend to take.
Yeah. You always kind of, when you look at the bronze medalist and it's like some underdog country too, you feel so good for them. But you're right. I'd never really remember looking at a silver medalist and feeling anything but like, oh man, I bet you're having a really bad time now. And you feel such relief. I'm proud of gold medalist winners, but I'm also like, you must be so relieved that this is over. For everybody, in fact, I'm always relieved that it's over. That's how you can tell I'm not cut out for these kinds of high stakes competition, because I'm just thinking, man, you can relax now. That must be so great. Maybe they're thinking the same thing, but who knows?
Well, I won't tell the USOC that you're not interested in being recruited for the next Olympics.
Let me deliver the news.
Yeah.
So regret helping us make decisions, it seems almost like a secondary function, right? Usually we just think, oh, regret makes us feel bad, and that's why we try to sweep it under the rug. But it also endows our life with, well, the moments in our lives with greater meaning. You write about this. Tell me about that.
Well, one of the things that happens is that when people regret a loss of meaning, so there's somebody in the book who I write about, it's a good example of this, who she grew up in Arizona, and her grandparents who lived in Indiana would come and visit for a couple of months. And she hated having them there. She thought it was an intrusion. Mm-hmm. And then her grandparents passed away. And she's like, oh my God, I blew it.
Yeah.
I could have learned from them. If only I had talked to them more, if only I had been more appreciative of their being there, I would have learned from their wisdom. I would have learned a little bit more about my family. And so she took that regret and said, you know what? Why am I feeling so bad about this? Because I lost that sense of meaning and connection to my relatives. And so what she did instead, this is a healthy way to deal with it. She felt terrible because she realized, like, oh my God, like I blew it. Like, if only I talked to them more, I'd have learned a lot about myself and about my family. And so what she did is she took that regret and she applied it forward. And now with her parents, she's got a subscription to this interesting service where every month they send a question to, usually for older people. Yeah.
They sponsor our show. It's called StoryWorth.
StoryWorth. Yeah. Oh, it's a great thing. StoryWorth. Yeah. It's fantastic. StoryWorth. Yes. It's actually, she got them a subscription to StoryWorth, and they send him a question every month and her dad answers it and they put it together in a book. And so the whole thing is like, wow, I missed out on some meaning in my life. I don't want to do that again. And so that's how I learned from
it. It's storyworth.com/Jordan. They don't sponsor this episode most likely, but you know, go to storyworth.com/Jordan, check it out. I'm having my mom do it. And it is, I have to say, it's really interesting. My mom, right, you know, they send a question like, what were some choices you made about how you raised your kids? Was one of them. That's the latest one that's in my inbox.
That's a question about both relief and regret.
Right.
So any parent, I'm a parent, my kids are 20 years older than yours. I'm a parent and I look back and I say, okay, what choices did I make? Mm-hmm. And some of them I rejoice over and some of them I regret. Mm-hmm. And when I think about what I regret, it actually allows me to extract a lesson that I can use going forward, that I can transmit to them, that I can transmit to other people.
But we have to handle the regret properly in order to make the meaning, right? We can't just like—
Exactly.
Wallow in our emotions.
And there's a systematic way to do that. Here's the thing. At a top level, here's the thing. It goes to what we were talking about earlier. No one ever taught us to deal with negative emotions. As a consequence of that, we think the best approach is sometimes just to ignore them. Mm-hmm. Bad idea. And when we can't ignore them, they end up hijacking us. Even worse consequence. We have to think about them, confront them. And so one thing to do, and looking at a lot of this research, is a very systematic way to do it. So one thing is sort of look inward. And use something, it's a powerful line of research with a pretty gooey name called self-compassion, where you treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt. When we screw up, our self-talk is brutal. And we would never talk to other people the way we talk to ourselves. So just treat yourself with some kindness and also recognize you're not that special. I went out and collected 16,000 regrets from people in 105 countries. So if you tell me you have a regret about bullying somebody when you were younger or not starting a business or not traveling enough, it's like, you're not alone. So that's the first thing, is look inward. Second thing, I can't tell you how important disclosure is, disclosing our regrets. There's something pretty powerful that 16,000 people around the world were willing to reveal their regrets to a complete stranger. That's incredible. And why is that? Because disclosure serves us in a number of ways. One, it unburdens. Two, most important, once again, if you look at the work of Jamie Pennebaker at Texas, if you look at the work of Sonia Lubomirsky at UC Riverside, when we write about or talk about negative emotions, mm-hmm. Back to your point, when we write or talk about negative emotions, we convert this kind of blobby, amorphous sensation into concrete words.
Hmm.
That makes them less fearsome. It helps us make sense of them. So disclosure unburdens and helps us make sense. What's more is, as a social phenomenon, and we're just totally wrong about this, we fear that when we disclose our vulnerabilities, our mistakes, people will think less of us. 30 years of research tells us they think more of us for doing that. So we sort of relieve ourselves, we disclose, and then we try to systematically draw a lesson from it. And the way to do that is to take a step back in time, take a step back with language, take a step back with space. Mm-hmm. I actually think one of the best decision-making tools there is of any kind, but certainly for regret, is to say, okay, suppose your best friend was going through this. What lesson did she learn and what would you tell her to do next? You do that, everybody always knows.
Oh, interesting. Right. So what would you advise someone else to do? Is that because we're divorcing ourselves from our personal, I guess, the baggage that surrounds it in terms of our emotions? Is that why it's easier to advise someone else to do something versus to...
There's a whole pile of research on this. Ethan Cross at Michigan has done a lot of it. Some really, really brilliant stuff. What it is that, okay, we do a crappy job of solving our own problems in general, because we're trying to solve an ocean problem, but we're scuba divers. We're like inside, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're sort of, okay, what we want to be is oceanographers, all right? You can't be a good oceanographer if you only do scuba diving. You want to zoom out. And the thing is like when with ourselves, we're so enmeshed in our own details and struggles and perspective and whatnot, we have to actually affirmatively zoom out. So what you can do, I mean, Cross's research is fantastic. One of the things you can do is you can say, okay, let me give you an example from my own self. Let's say that I have a regret about, I have some regrets about kindness. Okay, so let's say I have a regret about lack of kindness. And I have a regret about being too kind. No, I have a regret about lack of kindness. If I want to extract a lesson from it, what I can say is not what should I do, but hey, what should Dan do? What should Dan do in this? Talking to yourself in the third person is useful. Putting yourself in sort of a scientific mode, saying, mm-hmm. okay, you know what? Here you go. There's a regret. You have this regret and you're a doctor of regret sciences and you're examining this thing in this pristine laboratory room. What's your diagnosis? What's the next step? Your best friend is dealing with this. What lesson does she learn? What do you want her to do next? And so zooming out is one of the most important things. And so when we kind of treat ourselves with kindness, disclose the regret to make sense of it, and zoom out for a solution, it's easy.
Nice.
Just no one ever taught us how to do that.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Dan Pink. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored in part by Element. I'm sure you know by now how important it is to drink plenty of water, but did you know that replenishing your electrolytes is just as important? Whether you're working out or simply going on a walk, sweat-inducing activities not only make you lose water, but electrolytes as well. When it's too low, you get headaches, muscle cramps, fatigue, weakness. Element helps keep me hydrated through rigorous workouts. It's also perfectly suited to folks following keto, low-carb, paleo diets. What I like best, though, is clean ingredients, not too salty and not overpowered by sweetness. Element is so sure you'll love their product and come back for more, they're offering you a free Element sample pack. That's 8 single-serving packets free. Just cover the cost of shipping, $5 for U.S. customers.
Get yours at drinkelement.com/Jordan. This deal isn't available on their regular website. You must go to drinkelement.com/Jordan. Element offers no questions asked refunds. Try it totally risk-free. If you don't like it, share it with a salty friend, and they'll give your money back, no questions asked. You have nothing to lose.
This episode is also sponsored by Audible. Mel Robbins, a best-selling global phenomenon, one of the leading voices in personal development, is back with a new Audible original podcast, Here's Exactly What to Do, which invites you to reimagine the life you want and gives you the tools to take action. Each of the 14 episodes focuses on an attitude or situation that's holding you back. Is your confidence in need of a recharge? Is your creativity running low? Are you not carving out the right life balance, or are you just feeling blah and can't get out of bed? In her typical no BS style, Mel cuts through the hype to deliver simple tools you need to move forward and create positive change. These short, impactful episodes are the perfect way to take a break, take a breath, and feel truly empowered. Here's Exactly What to Do is the perfect follow-up to Start Here, her 13-topic breakdown of how to deal with whatever life is throwing at you.
Available only on Audible. Audible.com/whattodo.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. I love the fact that you like these conversations because I sure enjoy creating them for you. By the way, all the discount codes and all the deals, we put them all on one page. JordanHarbinger.com/deals is where you can find it. Please consider supporting those who support us. Now, back to Dan Pink.
I have an advice segment every Friday, and I often look at the advice that I'm giving, and I'm like, man, I wish I'd known or thought to do this when I encountered this similar situation 10 years ago. And then I think, would I do this right now? would I really do this? And so I try to be really honest about that on the show on Feedback Friday, because I'm like, okay, here's what you should do. You should handle it diplomatically and this and this and this and this. But what I would probably do is be super pissed off and tell everyone and ruin this person's reputation because they freaking deserve it. You know, and then I'm like, ah, but don't do that. That's bad and makes you look bad.
And then you regret it. But then you forgive yourself and you disclose it right. And you extract a lesson from it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you took this big survey. What do most people regret? You say bullying someone as a kid. What other sort of like giant categories stick out?
Yeah, this was fascinating. So I think one of the things that's super cool about the times we live in is that, you know, individual schmoes like me can do some pretty sophisticated large scale research. So as I mentioned, I did this big survey of the American population, the largest public opinion survey of American attitudes about regret ever conducted. We got some interesting stuff from there. Mm-hmm. But what was also interesting is another piece of research that I did called the World Regret Survey, where I simply collected regrets from all over the world. And what I found in reading through these regrets, thousands of them, literally thousands upon thousands of them from all over the world, is that around the world, people have the same four regrets over and over and over and over again. And in some ways, the traditional way we, even I, had been in my public opinion survey, I said I had people put their regrets, ask them their regrets, and then put them into categories like career, family, education, health, and so forth. And I found that that was not very revealing because there was something bigger going on beneath the surface, four core regrets that people had all over the world.
Okay. And what were they?
Well, I'll happily tell you. Yeah. So let me give you an example of one of them about how it spans domains. It took me a while to figure this out. So among Americans who went to college, huge numbers of people regret not studying abroad. It's unbelievable.
Really? Wow. I'm glad I did that then. Okay.
Oh, you did. Where'd you go?
When I was in high school, I went to Germany. Then in college, I went to Israel, Ukraine, Mexico, Panama, and Serbia. So I did it a lot.
Yeah. So those aren't, some of those places are not that close to the other places, but that's okay. Yeah. You've traveled around a lot.
Yeah.
So people regret not studying abroad. Okay, so that's an education regret. I have huge numbers of regrets from all over the world where someone has someone they're interested in romantically. They say, I like this person, this man or this woman. I want to ask him or her out on a date, but I never got around to it because I'm too chicken. Mm-hmm. And they've regretted it ever since. People regretting that for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years.
Yikes.
Huge numbers of regrets about people who say, oh, I stayed in this crappy job when all I wanted to do was start my own business, but I never had the guts to start a business. And I really regret not doing that.
Okay.
Okay, so that's a career regret. But all those regrets are the same.
Yeah.
It's a regret. No, here's the regret. You're at a juncture. You can play it safe or take the chance.
Oh, interesting.
You play it safe, you regret it. All right? So this is a boldness regret. And so this is a big category of regret. It doesn't matter the domain of life. It is that we have regrets about boldness. If only I'd taken the chance. So we also have foundation regrets, which are regrets about not doing the work. So regrets about smoking, not saving money that give you a wobbly foundation. We have these moral regrets, which include if only I'd done the right thing, which includes an amazing number of regrets about bullying.
Yeah.
I mean, I was shocked at how often those bullying regrets came up. A lot of regrets about infidelity, other kinds of moral breaches. And then finally, connection regrets, where you have a relationship that should have been intact. It comes apart usually in slow, undramatic ways. You want to reach out. You want to mend it. You want to get that connection. You don't do it, and you regret it. And to me, these four regrets are the path out of this pandemic. Because these four regrets are essentially a photographic negative of the good life. All these people telling us, by telling us their regrets, they're telling us what they value most in life. And over again around the world, it's the same four things. They value stability, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I don't have enough money to pay because I didn't save money. Oh my God, I endangered my health, all right? They value stability. Boldness. We're not here forever. We want to do something. We want to grow. We want to learn. We want to try stuff. We want to lead a psychologically rich life. Moral. I'm convinced that most people want to be good. And actually feel pretty crappy when they don't. Not everybody, but most of us actually want to be good and don't like not being good. The fourth one is connection, is love. And not only romantic love, I think our notions of love need to be expanded to our entire families, not just our romantic partner. Not only our kids, but just like our siblings and our other relatives and our friends and our colleagues. It's a different kind of love, but that's what it's all about. So that's what we need. We need stability. We need some growth. We need goodness and we need love. And that's it, man.
The photographic negative concept is pretty genius, right? Because we can look at all of these, we can even probably take our own inventory and go, oh, I really regret these types of things, which are what you just mentioned. And then since we know what people regret most, now we can focus on doing those things the right way. So if we regret not keeping in touch with our friends for a long time or something like that because we were too busy with life, now we can say, okay, well, it's not too late. Most of them are still around and willing to reconnect. at some level. So I think this is kind of like the one, if you're going to take one thing away from this episode, I think this is probably it, which is take an inventory of some of your biggest regrets and see which ones you can fix, mitigate, or at least not make the same type of mistake in the future. Because a lot of things I thought I would regret, like wasting a bunch of money on something, I literally can't even remember what those are anymore, and it doesn't matter in the least. And I remember when I was young, my parents would be like, you're going to regret spending $700 on this thing. And I'm like, now I'm like, $700? Who cares about that? No, I regret, you know, bullying this kid because everyone else was doing it and I felt bad for him, but I didn't have the guts to stand up for him and myself. Like, that's my regret. I don't care about wasting money on a Nintendo, right? So that sort of is able to shift our lives in a different direction. If we regret not choosing a career or not being bold or going out on a limb, then that guides our future decisions, but only if, only if we don't like sweep it under the rug and decide that because we went to a self-help seminar, we're not going to think about those things anymore.
I want to move from a self-help seminar to church, because yes. And just give you a big amen on that.
Sure.
I mean, I'm with you. Amen.
Otherwise, like you said, what's the use of regret? It obviously has a function. I guess a lot of animals don't have language, but if they did, they probably aren't thinking, man, I regret not, I don't know, what do gorillas regret? Not a whole lot, probably. I don't know. That's a survey you can do next for your next book.
I don't know. Gorillas might have more, you know, might be higher on the regret chain than, say, raccoons or jellyfish or something. But, you know, obviously animals learn.
Yeah, they learn, yeah.
You know, and regret is a form of learning. It's a very interesting question about my hunch. I have no idea and I have no way of proving or disproving this, is that regret is too sophisticated cognitively for most animals, most other animals besides human beings, to experience it and deploy it in a sophisticated way. I find that very, very hard to believe.
Yeah, it's kind of tough. I guess, look, somebody listening is probably like, no, I'm an expert in chimp behavior and they have regrets. They're just really...
Oh, I would love to hear from that. I would love to hear from that person, yeah.
If you are an expert in this area with animals and you think that they have regrets, definitely email me, jordan@jordanharbinger.com. I'm curious too, because if they have regrets, maybe they're really sort of, I don't want to be rude about it, but it's a chimp, whatever, unsophisticated. Like maybe there's some sort of basic regret, but it's not like, I wish I'd kept in touch with the other chimps at that last zoo. They were really nice folks. It's probably more like, I regret eating this certain thing. Or I guess that's almost like, then when does regret just become learning a lesson that happened based on behavior? I don't know. That's maybe a philosophical discussion.
Yeah. But I don't think chimps are saying, oh my God, you know, back at Chimp U, I had a chance to do a junior year abroad in Paris and I didn't do it.
Yeah, no. Oh man, yeah. I should have taken more advantage when I was at the Berlin Zoo. I really just stayed at home all the time. Now I'm back in New Jersey. Man, did I have it good over there. Well, what is the difference then between disappointment and regret, for example? Is there a difference? I mean,
huge.
It seems like there is, really?
There's a huge difference. And the difference is regret is your fault. Disappointment's not your fault.
Okay.
So I'll give you the best example. It's a parenting example. It's not mine. It's from Janet Landman, who has done a lot of work on regret at the University of Michigan. She says, okay, so imagine you got a three-year-old. Your 2.5-year-old hasn't lost a tooth yet.
No. Barely getting them. Yeah, just got it recently.
Great. Okay, so imagine you've got a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old, and the 6-year-old loses a tooth.
Okay.
Your kids start losing teeth around age 6. Okay, so your kid loses a tooth at age 6. Okay, so we know all about the tooth fairy. It's still a part of most American families' lives. Okay, so she loses a tooth. She puts a tooth underneath her pillow so the tooth fairy can come and replace that tooth take the tooth and give her a buck or something like that.
Right.
Okay. She wakes up the next morning. The tooth is still there. She's disappointed. Her parents regret not replacing the tooth with a dollar. All right. What's happening? It's one person's fault. The other person is a victim of circumstance. The other person actually has the agency that caused it. So regret is your fault. Listen, I'll give you a sports example. I'm a basketball fan. And unfortunately, I'm a basketball fan in Washington, D.C. And so our hometown team, the Washington Wizards. I'm always disappointed when the Wizards lose, but I can't regret it, right? I don't play. I don't coach. I don't own the team. It's not my fault. But, you know, the owners of the Wizards or, you know, Bradley Beal should regret blowing games.
Yeah.
Because it's their fault. I'm just disappointed.
That makes sense. Right. So it's sort of like, is this a locus of control? Yeah. Who has control over that situation?
Okay, great. Yeah. Come on, bring the social psychology language. Totally. Yeah. It's locus of control. It's agency. It's those kinds of things.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. But, you know, essentially regret is your fault. Disappointment is not your fault.
That's a good distinction because I think a lot of us maybe confuse the two. I mean, when I was reading the book, I was like, oh, I regret these things. Oh, wait, no, I don't. I was just annoyed or sad that those happened, but I don't really truly regret it because it's hard to regret something that you didn't even know about.
Yeah.
Because you really didn't, if you never even thought about studying abroad, you might regret not doing it. But really, if you didn't know that was an option, or you were so poor that there was no chance in hell it was ever going to happen.
Of course.
It's not really fair to you to regret that kind of thing.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. I agree with that 100%. And that's true for this one category of regrets about foundation regrets. So let's talk about this.
Foundation regret.
The foundation regrets are if only I'd done the work. Okay. These are regrets about saving money and health and so forth. So imagine you have a regret about saving money. I got a lot of people with regrets. The very poignant story of a guy in Tennessee who is 43 years old, very successful career. And he said, he looks up and he says, at age 43, I've been working my butt off he started working when he was 18. Very successful guy. Started working my butt off when I was 18. 25 years later, I don't have any money. I don't have anything to show for it.
Oh, man.
Because, it's terrible, right?
Yeah.
There are a lot of things like that. Now, imagine you have somebody who is, say, 35 years old, and she says, oh, my God, I regret not saving enough money. And then you unpack the story and you say, well, wait a second. Your parents couldn't afford to send you to college, but you went to college anyway, and you were saddled with $130,000 of student loans. All right? You've been working your whole life. That's not entirely on you.
Right.
So we have to think about what do we have agency over? What do we not have agency over? On boldness, we often have a lot of agency. On moral, we often have a lot of agency. On connection, we often have a lot of agency. With foundation, it's a little murkier. But we do have agency. I don't want to exonerate people to say that, oh, you have no responsibility for taking care of your finances or your health or your overall, well-being.
Yeah, I don't think most people, well, I don't know. Do most people let themselves off the hook too easily? Probably not people who listen to this. I think mostly people who listen to this are busy beating themselves up over things that they don't have control over as opposed to trying to shove responsibility off of themselves. Although who knows? It's a big audience. There's a lot of people in it with different personality types. I'm wondering, in the survey or in your research, did you find that people mostly regretted things that they did versus things that they did not do, or the other way around? So that's an unclear question, but did most people regret doing something or not doing something, I guess?
It's a very clear question, and it's central to the architecture of regret. Here's what we know. In general, especially over time, people regret what they didn't do much more than what they did do. Regrets of inaction outnumber regrets of action, and this is especially true as people age. One of the clearest findings in my own quantitative research is that around age 20, people had about equal numbers of regrets of action and inaction. So in the quantitative survey, I had people report their regret and then categorize it. Is it a regret of inaction or action? Something I did or something I didn't do. And in the early 20s, people had about the same number of action and inaction regrets. As people age, the chart looks like this. And it's just inaction regrets take over.
Wow.
So
why do you think that is?
Well, there are all kinds of reasons. One of them is that for action regrets, you can sometimes do something.
Oh, right.
You can get that no regrets tattoo removed. You can apologize to that kid you bullied. You can find an at least. It's like, okay, I shouldn't have married that guy, but at least I have these three great kids. Inaction regrets always bug you because they remain unresolved. You have this floating what if over you all the time. And in many cases, a lot of the inaction regrets end up being things that, especially things like boldness and connection that really, really, really deeply bring meaning to our lives. The idea of leading a psychologically rich life and doing something is, I think that is a fundamental human impulse. And when we thwart it, it doesn't go away. We have an innate need to have affinity and connection and belonging with other people. And when that doesn't happen, it doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Inaction regrets really, really linger.
We also, I think there's a lot of research on people who have close relationships, friends, marriages, whatever it is. They're healthier and they live longer. So it would make sense that
it's not even close.
It's not even close, right? Yeah. So as you get older, you probably start to really acutely feel alone if you never got married, never have kids, and just was spending money on yourself and traveling around. It's like, well, when you get older, you just find yourself in a smaller and smaller box.
I mean, there is a famous, renowned study called the Grant Study, started at Harvard in the 1930s, I think. I'm forgetting. It's one of the largest longitudinal studies ever conducted in psychological science, where it's distorted a little bit because they started following these guys who are all men, all white, who are at Harvard as undergraduates. And then they follow them all the way through their lives. Ben Bradley was part of this cohort. I think John F. Kennedy was part of this cohort. They checked in on them all the time. And some of them were successful. Some of them were healthy. Some of them were not. But the people who flourished had satisfying relationships. The people who floundered did not have satisfying relationships, period. It didn't matter the money. It actually didn't matter the physical health. And even the guy who started this, he has a really interesting unpublished paper with the results, some of the results. And he says, I can describe the results of this like 7-decade study in human flourishing. I can describe it in 5 words. Happiness is love, full stop.
Wow. Wow.
And he's right. I don't want to get woo-woo on you, but he's totally right.
No, I mean, it makes sense. I'm quote unquote only, but I'm 41 and I'm like, you know, I don't regret all of the fun things that I did that involved other people, but I often regret all the work I put into certain things in my 20s at the expense of having, like, classic example, I worked really hard in college and then I worked really hard in grad school. And I'm like, if I had to do it over again, I would probably do way less studying and way more socializing. Because I was like, I'm not going to be that guy who goes to college and just joins a fraternity and makes a bunch of friends and hangs out. I lived in the library. And now I'm like, you know, that got me in some ways to where I am today. But in other ways, I really could have had a lot more relationships from college instead of like the tiny handful of people I still keep in touch with that I like lived with, you know, lived next to them or studied with them. And it's like the only people I know from those connections. And it's funny because now if I had to advise someone else, going back to your earlier point, I would say make as many friends and connections as possible and don't worry about the skull shapes of pre-humans as much as you did.
Oh, no, I think that you should. I disagree with the second part of that. I think the skull shapes of pre-humans are revealing about who we are as human beings. And what were you, an anthropology major?
You know, I took a bunch of those classes. It was like, here's Australopithecine skull shape. It has a brow ridge and like a little, I forget, like a crest or something. And I'm like, that's not serving me super well. Really glad I missed out on
it. Sure it is. Sure it is. It makes you less intimidated by evolution and by neuroscience later in your life.
Fair. Reframing.
Here's the thing. You know, it's like we got to do both. I have plenty of people who regret not working hard enough in college because it gave them an uncertain foundation.
Oh, interesting.
The question is, you know, is there an inherent trade-off between having a solid academic foundation and building those connections? And I don't think the trade-off is inherent. I actually think that one can do both.
You can do both. Yeah.
But one has to be very intentional about it.
I basically decided I shouldn't do one because it would mean that I'm not doing enough of the other, which is total nonsense. Because what happened
right,
was...
Right, exactly. That's just a story you're telling yourself.
Right. It was like I spent more time...
You need to go
time,
to a self-help seminar.
Yeah, I need to get a tattoo to remind myself that I should not have worried about this. Speaking of inaction regrets, this is an interesting phenomenon that I experienced that maybe people can relate to, and maybe you even have some light to shed on this. I left an old company about 5 years ago. And I realized very quickly, or I should say, I immediately regretted not leaving that company earlier. And so when I talked about it on this show, and people would say, Jordan, I love you, man, but it's really cringe and sour grapes that you're saying that you'd wish you'd left earlier. I know you love Aesop's Fables. But I will say now, with 5 years of hindsight or experience behind me, it really wasn't sour grapes. It was, since the decision to leave that company was largely made outside of my control due to a dispute, I wanted to leave, but I couldn't. And then suddenly it was like, you're leaving, but not necessarily on your terms. I just had a sudden realization that I should have split earlier, and it all came rushing in very quickly. And at first, I think a lot of outsiders, it sounded like a rationalization that would make me feel better. Like, oh, I'm so glad I'm gone. But really, now I'm like, nope, I'm really and always have been very glad that I'm gone. It was more of a realization instead of a rationalization, but it happened like overnight almost. And I wonder if that's common.
I think so. I think the key is like, what's the lesson you learn from it?
The lesson was when you start having these inkling or these feelings of, well, I really should do this, but here's a bunch of reasons I can't. Maybe those reasons are keeping you comfortable and keeping you, you know, it's fear-based. And maybe that means you should try a little bit friggin' harder to make those things happen, or at least stop sweeping it under the rug. Because what I did was I went, I can't do this now. You know, it's too late.
But I think that you learned a lesson from that. The thing is,
absolutely.
But here's the thing. This is why it's so interesting. It's like regret delivers some pain, not massive pain, mm-hmm. but a little bit. But it also delivers learning. Thing is, you can't have one without the other. You want the learning, you got to have a little bit of the pain.
Yeah.
And the thing is, that pain, modest as it is worth withstanding because it's the only way to deliver the learning. These upward counterfactuals that we're talking about, the at least I didn't do that. They make us feel better, but they don't help us do better. If onlys make us feel worse and help us do better. In fact, and this is the key, they help us do better because they make us feel worse. Feeling worse is a signal to pay attention to what's going on here and learn from it.
This is the Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Dan Pink. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored in part by Bull & Branch. We spend a third of our lives in bed. Well, if you're a parent, you spend more or maybe less or more, but getting less sleep. But anyway, high-quality, comfortable sheets, not worth cutting corners on. Bull & Branch make the highest quality sheets, doing things the right way, not the easy way. I was naive in my younger years, made the mistake of purchasing inexpensive sheets that didn't end up holding up in the wash at all. But I've learned better. We love our Bull & Branch's 100% organic cotton weight signature hemmed sheets that actually get softer with every wash, toxin-free and fair trade certified, buttery soft. It's what I imagine it's like sleeping on a cloud of, I guess, butter. I don't know. Bull & Branch pays attention to the details, labeling the sides of the fitted sheet to make your life easier, and so you put the right side on the first time. That's a brilliant idea, by the way. Husband and wife team Scott and Missy Tannen founded Bull & Branch to create new standards in bedding by doing things the right way so you can sleep easy knowing that.
Experience the best sheets you've ever felt at bullandbranch.com. Get 15% off your first set of sheets when you use promo code Jordan at checkout. That's Bull & Branch, BOLLAND branch.com, promo code Jordan.
This episode is also sponsored by Freshly. Jen and I are way too busy lately to meal plan. It hasn't been friendly on the waistline. Freshly offers quality meals without the hard work. Fresh at my waistline. Just to be clear, my waistline. Freshly meals are designed by nutritionists, cooked by chefs, and then delivered fresh, never frozen. Other meal deliveries need to be prepped and cooked, but Freshly's ready to eat in 3 minutes. Got a new baby, got a 2-year-old toddler. Jen and I, we just don't have enough hands to spend time preparing food, much less go grocery shopping and deal with dirty dishes. Freshly has healthy options for the whole family. Instead of eating out or grabbing the same old takeout all the time, we've scheduled our Freshly meals to make our lives easier. There are over 50 nutritionist-designed entrees to choose from, like their classic steak peppercorn, multi-serve sides like their masterful mac and cheese, or their new line of plant-based meals.
Stop stressing about dinner. Right now, Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders when you go to freshly.com/Jordan. That's $40 off at freshly.com/Jordan.
This episode is also sponsored in part by Progressive. Progressive helps you get a great rate on car insurance, even if it's not with them. They have this nifty comparison tool that puts rates side by side so you choose a rate and coverage that works for you. So let's say you're interested in lowering your rate on your car insurance. Visit progressive.com, get a quote with all the coverage you want. You'll see Progressive's rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies, all lined up and easy to compare. All you have to do is choose the rate and coverage that you like. Progressive gives you options so you can make the best choice for you. You could be looking forward to saving money in the very near future. More money for, say, a pair of noise-canceling headphones, an Instapot, more puzzles, whatever brings you joy. Get a quote today at Progressive.com. It's one small step you can do today that could make a big impact on your budget tomorrow.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
By the way, you can now rate the show if you're listening on Spotify. This is a huge help for us. I think it's going to make the show more visible on Spotify as well. Just go to jordanharbinger.com/Spotify or search for us in your Spotify app and click those three dots on the upper right to make it happen. Now for the rest of my conversation with Dan Pink. That makes sense. I mean, look, at the end of the day, it's hard to say if I would have been in as good of a position to restart my business if I'd left earlier. So I try not to really beat myself up about it too much because, oh my God, I should have left 3 years, 4 years, 5 years earlier. Yeah, but then would I have been totally screwed, not as experienced enough, not have the right connection? Like, you really can't kind of rewrite
it. Right.
But it was interesting to find that something I thought was going to be impossible or extremely difficult almost overnight turned into, man, why didn't I do this earlier? This is so ridiculous. It's probably how people feel when they leave an abusive relationship where they're like, I can't, I'm going to be alone, I'm never going to find someone. And then 3 months later, they're like, I don't wake up stressed every day, I'm happier. There's all these different things that they didn't realize were going to happen.
I think you're right. And I think there's a bigger point there. And once again, you know, social psychology has figured out some of this, is that we are lousy forecasters, especially about our own lives. You know, the classic example of it is if you ask people, so I'm in my 50s. So if you were to say to me, okay, here you go. You have different tastes in music and food and culture than you'd had when you were 25. Yeah, totally. Now, go forward 25 years. Do you think you're going to have different tastes in music, culture? Oh, no. I'm just going to be exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't realize. We think that current me is done. Like, we've been evolving. We've been becoming totally different people, you know, throughout our entire lives. From the time that we were your daughter's age and we were just like blobby, cute little things, to the time we're toddling around like your older kid, to the time that, you know, we're becoming different people. But then the moment we're in right now, we think, it's done.
It's done.
I'm me. It's over. And it's not. And so when we forecast what our life is going to be like. We don't recognize we're making a forecast about a different person.
Right. Oh.
And so that's another reason why we are really, 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 really bad forecasters. So this goes to anticipated regret. A lot of times we anticipate regrets. And as Dan Gilbert at Harvard says, we buy emotional insurance we don't need. That is, we're worried about regrets. We're worried about certain kinds of regrets, and they end up not materializing. Mm. And so we make different decisions to avoid those anticipated regrets. So anticipating regrets is useful, but not perfect. I'll give you an example. Let's take multiple choice tests. All right, multiple choice tests. So when I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, the guidance on multiple choice tests was this. Let's say you got question 9 and you think the answer is C. And then you're going along and you're like, wait a second. I think the answer to question 9 is B. Should you go back and change your answer or should you go with your first instinct?
Okay. So I learned through painful experience to just not change the answers because for some reason, when you're really thinking about that question and you're in that zone and you're going, you're all this studying and also your gut will tell you if you have no idea what the answer is and you just blindly picked A, B, C, or D, fine, go back and change it if you have an inkling. But if you had a reason for choosing one, I don't think you should go back and change it, man. I've done that too many times.
Okay. Perfect answer because it's very revealing.
Really?
Here is what the evidence tells us. And this is not a close call. Here's what the evidence tells us. That in general, not in every instance, that you are much more likely to switch from a wrong answer to a right answer. That actually switching is a good idea.
Really? Right? Oh my God.
Yes. But here's the thing. You just articulated exactly the reason why. Because we anticipate much more regret, especially when it actually has happened in our lives.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
If we switch, you got it. All
if
right?
you switch you're a right student. Answer to a wrong one, it feels
boom,
so shitty.
You got
yeah,
it.
That's funny.
Right. So we anticipate. It's like, yeah. Oh my God, if I switch from B to C and I'm wrong, I'm going to so regret it.
Yeah.
And you're going to regret it less than sticking with a wrong answer.
Totally.
It's the same outcome.
Yeah. That's funny.
So what we're doing, in Dan Gilbert's phrase, is that we're buying emotional insurance we don't need, and we end up so anticipated regret sometimes leads us to bad, often very risk-averse decisions.
That's so funny.
So we need to anticipate our regrets properly, and the way to do that is to anticipate what the things are we really will regret in our lives. And we know that from these 16,000 people. We know that 10 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, far less likely to regret the action of spending $700 on that Nintendo system than you are to regret the inaction of not staying in touch with people who you were once close to.
That totally makes sense. Man, it's so funny. I would even go as far as to regret changing an answer on a test where I'm not sure if those answers were wrong later, and I will just assume that those were changed to wrong answers, and that's why my score is lower. So it's all like a narrative in my own head. I know I'm not the only one who does this, for sure.
No way.
That's funny. So if we have, you call these open versus closed door regrets. If we have open door regrets where we can maybe change the current situation, does it help us to try to remedy it, like reconnect with old friends or apologize to that kid that we bullied? And what about the closed door ones where like that person has passed away and we can't do that anymore?
Yeah.
What do we do with those?
Well, I mean, with open door regrets, it's important, especially with the connection regrets, it's really important to do something. I'll give you an example. The biggest lesson for me in all of this is like we think about these connection regrets, all right? You're at a juncture. Mm-hmm. Should I reach out or should I not reach out? If you're at a juncture where you're wondering whether to reach out, in my mind, you've answered the question. Always reach out. Mm-hmm. Always reach out because the door is still open. Now, I have a story of somebody in the book who had a friend, a close childhood friend, who ended up developing very pernicious, horrible form of cancer.
Oh, man.
And this woman wanted to reach out to her friend. She knew her friend was in trouble, felt kind of awkward. She didn't reach out. She waited a little longer. She finally called her. And that morning, the friend passed away.
Oh, man. Right?
So it's horrible, right? That's a closed door regret. But what did this person do? Her first name is Amy. This person, Amy. She's like, oh my God, okay, that's terrible. I feel terrible. No regrets. Do I ignore that? No. Mm-hmm. Do I wallow in it? Probably not psychologically healthy. What do? I learn from it. And then sadly, but happily in a weird way, she had another friend in that situation and she treated it totally differently, where she called the friend regularly, they exchanged text messages, and that friend too sadly passed away. But Amy says, no, I don't have any regrets about that. So what did she do? She forgave herself. She disclosed the regret. She extracted a lesson from it and she did better next time. And that's what we do with closed door regrets.
Is essentially change our course of behavior and not sit there and beat yourself up. That makes a lot of sense.
Confront it. Don't ignore it. confront it, forgive yourself, disclose it, extract a lesson from it, do better next time.
When you were taking your survey, you mentioned they changed a little bit by age. Was it different for men versus women as well?
It's interesting. So for the quantitative survey, I sort of regret not asking this question because there's some other research on this, but I did separate people by, the sample is large enough that I could do crosstabs by gender. Mm. And there were some differences between men and women in the surface domains of their regrets. So men had more career regrets than women. Women had more family regrets than men. I don't think that's a big surprise. There's other research showing in the existing academic literature, to oversimplify a bit, having to do with sexual regrets. Mm-hmm. And in general, to oversimplify a bit, men typically regret the people they didn't sleep with, and women tend to regret the people they did sleep with.
Also not a huge surprise, probably. I think, yeah, I won't go into that one. Okay. Thought about it, anticipated the regret of going into that subject, changed course of the interview.
Well done.
So it's working already. Yeah, it's working already. You have a practical or a technique in the book that I like, which is mentally subtracting positive events. Can you us through this? This is kind of, I'd never thought or heard about this.
Yeah, this is a good way to do a downward counterfactual and at least to make yourself feel a little bit better. And it's based on some interesting research in social psychology about this capacity for time travel. And essentially what you do is you think about your current life and you take away something that is important and imagine that it never happened. So you can think about, let's say I had never met my wife. Mm-hmm. All right. I mentally subtract that. It is a hellscape. And I imagine, you know, sort of imagine what my life would be like. It is a hellscape. And it makes you more grateful in the moment. It makes you more appreciative of what you have. And it's a way to, you know, sort of calm yourself and feel better about the moment by mentally subtracting those positive events. And it's sort of built on the technique that was done in It's a Wonderful Life, where George Bailey is visited by an angel and the angel tapes him back and says, look what this town, whatever the town is called.
I can't remember at all.
I can't remember either. Look what the town is called if you had never been born. And it was a hellscape. And I'm going to use that word again.
I'm going to look this up because otherwise people are going to email us and be like, it's called Bedford Falls, which is what it's called.
Right.
Wait, it doesn't say what it would have been called, but it was called Bedford Falls. Oh, it is now Pottersville.
Right. Right. Because I was the bad guy in the savings and loan. Right.
Right. Okay.
You know, so George Bailey is visited by an angel and the angel takes George and shows him what Bedford Falls would be like if he, George, hadn't been born. So it is a mental subtraction of a positive event. It is a counterfactual. And the what George sees is a hellscape, that his presence on the planet actually made Bedford Falls a better, kinder, richer place.
So what is the purpose of this again? Just to, I mean, of course, in his case, it's to make him, I don't know, feel better about himself or something like that.
Yeah, no, it's a technique for making us feel better.
Okay.
And sometimes we simply do want to feel better. And so if you have a regret that is hard to undo and you still feel bad about it and you've already extracted a lesson from it, but it's still lingering, you can try to do an at least. You can say, oh, I should have studied abroad. I'm going to try to go to Italy next year. I still feel bad about not studying abroad, but at least that junior year, I made my good friend Hiram, and that's really important to me.
Okay. So this is like a, almost like a rationalization process, but something that's a little bit more better than just, it's a more organized way to do this. And I can get behind that. I think it's important to do that, but there's got to be...
It deepens your... And you know what it does is it can deepen your sense of gratitude for what you have.
There you go.
And we know that having a sense of gratitude, actually explicitly feeling and expressing gratitude, is very, very good for us.
Can we overdo this kind of thing with regret aversion or anticipating regret? It seems like there's a way to just do this so much that it blows up in our face.
100%. You're totally right. One of the things that you see is, I mean, it's pretty well-known research having to do with the way that people make decisions or anticipate their decisions, both make decisions and anticipate courses of action. Some people are maximizers. They're like, I'm going to get the best out of everything. I'm going to maximize every single decision.
Yeah.
Other people are satisficers. Okay, some things are good enough. And what the research tells us very clearly, it's not even close, is maximizers are miserable. They're just miserable because you can't maximize in everything. And I think an important lesson in life, and especially in how we, and certainly how we reckon with our regrets, is that when we anticipate our regrets, if we try to maximize by minimizing every regret, should I have potato chips or corn chips? Which one will I regret more? You know,
right.
Should I have macaroni and cheese or a hamburger? Should I buy a blue car or a gray car? You're going to go crazy.
Yeah.
What we should do is we should, on most of our choices, and this is hard for people to deal with because we're in this world of maximization. On a lot of our choices, we should just satisfice because it's not going to matter. It's your Nintendo story there. All right. However, we do know from a chorus of 16,000 people, the stuff we will regret over the long term. And so we should maximize on building our stability, our connections, our boldness, and our morality. And I think that gives us a lesson for living. It's, you know, we want to optimize our regrets, which is satisfying on a lot of things, but maximize by anticipating what we know you're going to regret for an enduring time, because we know that these enduring regrets give us signals for what makes life worth living.
Interesting. So we don't want to necessarily minimize our regret, but kind of optimize our regret. I think maybe you even wrote about this. Yeah.
Bingo.
So we want to do it right instead of just not doing it at all or doing it so much that now it's, yeah, we're spending 6 months deliberating the color of the car.
Exactly. I mean, it's a dirty little secret. Maximizers are miserable. Okay. If I think, oh my God, should I put on my gray sweater today or my blue sweater today? You know, oh, which one? I mean, you're going to go crazy. You can't maximize. And what's even worse than that is that not only do you end up making bad decisions in the moment, but you have huge opportunity costs because you're not thinking deliberately about the stuff that really does matter, which is like, yeah, you should reach out to that friend you haven't talked to. Yeah, you should do the right thing here at this juncture rather than the wrong thing, because they're going to bug you if you don't do the right thing. You know, yeah, play it safe or take the chance. You know what? Take the chance, because you're probably not going to regret that. And the other stuff doesn't really matter.
Dan, thanks so much for coming on the show, Dan. I really appreciate it. Great conversation, as always.
Jordan, always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for having me.
You're about to hear a preview of the Jordan Harbinger Show with a former pimp and how he uses mind manipulation.
A pimp teaches a woman how to manipulate men. So I'm teaching her. But what she notices after the teachings or during the teachings is that, hey, you're a man too. So it's only natural that she works these feminine wiles on you. A smart prostitute will make a fool out of a stupid pimp any day. So any vice you may have, they're just hooks. It gets to the point where you become a narcissistic sociopath. You become empty. You become hollow. You experience no joy. You experience no pain. You want no love. You want no hate. You're just an empty room. You can't love money. You can't hate it. See, the puppet master cannot have any interests, any wants, any lusts, any desires, any dreams, any goals, nothing. Why? So he can control your lust, your dreams, your desires. You don't do anything so that you can become everything. I have an aversion for women who are 6 feet tall. And like one woman said, in my heels, I'm 6'5". You're 5'7", but I find myself looking up to you. See, I'm 10 feet tall around her. And she's all powerful in my presence, so we can't separate. Anything that was insecure about you that you thought, it evaporates. You know, I've been shot twice. I've been stabbed once. Mexican mafia tried to kill me in my sleep. I've done 3 bank robberies in my life, 2 on purpose, 1 by accident. Knowing what I know, the scars I've received, the consequences that I pay, would I do it all again tomorrow? Yeah, I would. It was that good of a ride. I would not be strong enough to resist the allure. It does have a deep psychological effect, and the only way to avoid the effects is to stay there. Even the woman I told you who lives in the $11 million house, we just got quiet one time, and I said, you ever miss it? And she said, every day.
For a chilling peek into the shadow world and the life and mind of a former pimp, Mickey Royal, check out episode 548 of The Jordan Harbinger Show. Hope y'all enjoyed listening to this one. Personally, I have no regrets about this episode. If you're thinking it might be creepy, by the way, to reach out to somebody who you haven't spoken to in a while, just think about this. Think about how you would feel if they reached out to you. Would it be creepy? The answer almost always is no. So, if you're worried about how you do that or you're feeling awkward about doing that, definitely go and check out 6-Minute Networking. I made the course just for people who are feeling that way. It takes just a few minutes a day. JordanHarbinger.com/course is where you can find it. Super, super easy. Not even 6 minutes. I would have called it Not Even 6-Minute Networking, but it seemed a little bit less catchy than 6-Minute Networking. JordanHarbinger.com/course is where you can find it. And the book, by the way, it's interesting. It has all these anonymous people's regrets inserted through it. Dan Pink is a great writer. Big thank you to him for coming on. Links to all things Dan Pink will be in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com. Please use our website links if you do buy the book. It does help support the show. Transcripts in the show notes, and there's a video of the interview on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram, or connect with me on LinkedIn. Anywhere you can find me, I always enjoy engaging with you. This show is created in association with Podcast One. My team is Jen Harbinger, Jace Sanderson, Robert Fogarty, Millie Ocampo, Ian Baird, Josh Ballard, and Gabriel Mizrahi. Remember, we rise by lifting others.
The fee for this show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful or interesting. If you know somebody who's dealing with some regrets, definitely share this episode with them. I hope you find something great in every episode of this show. The greatest compliment you can give us is to share this show with those you care about. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen, and we'll see you next time. Are you ready for a podcast that doesn't hold back? Check out The Adam Carolla Show, the number one daily downloaded podcast in the world, 5 days a week and completely uncensored. Join Adam as he shares his thoughts on current events, relationships, politics, and so much more. Adam welcomes a wide range of special guests to join him in studio for in-depth interviews and a front row seat to his freewheeling point of view. Download, subscribe, and tune in to The Adam Carolla Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts.